So yesterday we saw how the natural distance on some set of quantum states, if this set of quantum states is induced by the mapping that given a Hamiltonian depending on some parameters through the, we find the ground state psi 0 of lambda. So if this defines our ground state manifold, so we have a natural metric on here that when we pull back to the space of parameter induces a complex metric tensor on the space of parameters M, which is called a quantum geometric tensor. And we saw that we can have, so that we can write it. So this is the definition. And we saw that we can have an expression in terms of the variation of the Hamiltonian. So namely, we can expand in a Hamiltonian eigenbasis, and then arguments that are pretty much those of first-order perturbation theory. Show that we can write this object like psi 0 of lambda, then mu h, then we have psi n of lambda, psi n of lambda, then mu h, psi 0 of lambda. And here we have en of lambda, so the energy of the nth eigenstate minus the energy of the ground state, E0 of lambda squared. So this is the gap squared. So, and we have seen that imaginary part of Q mu nu is a two-form F mu nu that is the adiabatic curvature. So today we will explore what happens to the real part of Q mu nu. So yesterday we made the comment that for a critical, in a quantum critical point, then d square goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit, delta square. And therefore it seems that from this expression, we are tempted to see that Q mu nu might diverge, might blow up. So we saw in an example that, for instance, this happens to the adiabatic curvature. And now we will start looking at the real part of Q mu nu that we call G mu nu, and show that, again, in some examples, that this would blow up at a quantum critical point. OK. So before showing this, I also want to give another meaning to what what it means for Jimmy New to blow up. What does it mean? Okay, so another meaning is this. So we can define, let me define this operator, O of lambda, which is a unitary operator obtained in this way. I simply take the state psi n, so this is some eigenstate of our Hamiltonian for some parameter lambda, and I map it into the eigenstate for the corresponding value lambda plus some delta lambda. Okay? So this is the operator that if you apply it on psi n of lambda, it will give you psi n of lambda plus delta lambda. Okay, so this operator. And now let me define this observable. X mu is defined as I the mu o, so I differentiate it with respect to the lambda mu, o dagger. Okay, and now let me define this x bar just like x mu minus the expectation value of x mu. Okay, so one can show that then one can express g mu nu as 1/2 of the anti-commutator between x mu and x nu bar. So this is some result. And also that, so from this, you can also show that ds square is equal to the expectation value of x bar square. So, but because x bar is this, oh, okay, so I actually, so this is x mu. So let me define just x. So x is defined like dO or dagger with the I. And dO is simply the differential. So it's dO over the lambda mu, the lambda mu. And I'm summing over all the mu's. OK. So with these definitions, we obtain this. So we see that we have some observable that is defining how susceptible is our operator that maps nearby states. And a blowing up of our line element means a blowing up of this variance. So this is one result. So ds squared going to infinity means that the variance of x blows up. OK. So now let's see what happens in a concrete example. So we will again use our XY model, which, so let me repeat, is sum j from minus m to m, then a 1 minus gamma over 2, sigma x j, sigma x j plus 1, plus 1 minus plus gamma over 2, sigma y, plus h, sigma z. So we know that our phase diagram is defined by the following critical lines. So h equal plus or minus 1. And then h smaller than 1 and gamma equals 0. We also know that our single particle energies can be written in this way, epsilon square k plus gamma square sin square 2 pi k over L, where L is the total length of the chain, is 2m minus 1. And OK, so this epsilon k are 2 pi k over L minus h. And then we know we like to define these angles that are useful, that are, so the cosine of this angle is epsilon k over lambda k. OK, so this is our model. And now we want to compute the Riemannian tensor G min nu. Okay. So we have to plug in that formula. So a straightforward calculation so the calculation of doing the first order perturbation theory, and this calculation will constitute homework. So this calculation shows that this can be written like 1 over half, the sum over the k from 1 to m of d theta k over d lambda mu, d theta k over the lambda nu. Okay, so this is a formula for our G min nu. So we now would like to compute these objects. Okay? So now mu and nu take these two values that are, so these are our parameters, right? So they are gamma and h. Or in the sense that lambda mu can be either gamma or h for mu equal 1 and 2. Right? These are just our parameters. So by this, I just mean 1 over 2, the sum over all the k's. And then I have the tensor, so the matrix where I have d theta k square over d gamma square, and here I have d square theta k over dh square, and then I have d theta d gamma dh, and here I have the transposed. So I mean just the t theta k dh the gamma, but they are the same, of course. Is it a second derivative or the derivative squared? Yeah, this is the derivative squared, thank you. Okay. See?
L is what you call M?
So here?
No, but because now you choose M, but up there, in the sign.
Okay, so the calculations of these derivatives is straightforward. So let me write the result. So this square is equal to gamma square sin square xk. So here I define this variable xk being 2 pi k over L. So at this point, this is still a discrete variable because we didn't take the thermodynamic limit yet. And then we have d theta k over d gamma square equal sine square xk times cosine xk minus h square over lambda 4k. Oh, and there is a lambda 4k here too. And then the mixed term and this is equal to gamma sine square xk cosine xk minus h again over lambda 4. Okay, so in order to evaluate the components g mean nu, we have to make this sum, right? Because these are just the k labeled components. But g mean nu is the sum over all the possible k's. So now the evaluation of this becomes a closed formula in the thermodynamic limit. Otherwise, one has pretty much to do numerical calculations. But in the thermodynamic limit, you can substitute the sum over all the k's with L over 2 pi integral between 0 and pi of dx. And then xk becomes just x, a continuous variable. OK. So if you do this and then you do the integral, then you can compute g mean nu. So let me write the explicit components of g mean nu for in the whole part of the diagram in which h is smaller than 1, and just because these are shorter formula to write. So you have minus 16 over L, 1 plus gamma absolute value over gamma absolute value, then 0, 0. So it's a diagonal matrix. We have 16 over L, H plus H squared plus gamma squared plus 1 over H squared plus gamma squared. Minus 1. Okay, so this is the matrix g mean nu. So there is also an expression that you can compute. So it's long calculation, but it is about doing this integral. And unfortunately, it's a very long expression. Doesn't help very much to write. So what we want to see here is that when gamma equals 0, so when gamma goes to 0, so we know that we have our critical line. So you remember in our phase diagram, this gamma, this is h. So we have these critical lines. But now we are in the xy critical region, that is this one. This one. Well, we see that for gamma equals 0, this term would blow up. So g mean nu for gamma equals 0 blows up. And so we can actually compute. So once you have the matrix, you can compute everything else. So you can compute the Riemannian curvature and the curvature tensor. And so in the end, you can compute the Ricci scalar. by contracting the right indices. So the Ricci scalar in this part of the phase diagram, so for h absolute value smaller than 1, becomes, so let me, I actually can give you both values because these are short formulae. So for h smaller than 1 is minus 16 over L, 1 plus gamma over gamma. So it's just this, this component. Whereas for h greater than 1, oh, so I made a mistake. So I wrote the wrong things here. So for h greater than 1, this is that part. So let me write it again. That is h plus h squared plus gamma squared plus 1 over square root of h squared plus gamma squared minus 1. So in our G mean nu, we have 1 over 1 minus h squared and 1 over 1 plus gamma squared. So this is our so if you write, so I don't want to write the whole expression for this, but we will see that there is some discontinuity in the way it changes from this region to this region. So at gamma equals 0, some derivative of G mean nu is blowing up. And the way to see it is just to compute the Ricci scalar. And so you, because this contains the derivatives of G mean nu, then you see what happens at gamma equals 0. Yeah.
Because we have that when you, I was just wondering about the factor. Because you wrote that when you wrote those terms in the metric, you had 16 over L as a factor in front of the Ricci scalar for H larger.
Yeah, yeah. So this is for the Ricci scalar.
Okay. But there's no factor in front of.
No.
Okay.
No. I'm sorry. So there is this.
But then the Ricci scalar doesn't have any unit. Right?
Okay, so we see. Yeah, so what I said initially is right. This is blowing up at gamma equals 0. Yeah, sorry about that. So what did you say?
That then the Ricci scalar for h a greater than 1 doesn't have unit, the correct unit.
So you're right. There is this term here.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure. I don't understand why you erased what was in G mean nu to write this simpler form. Like what happened between those expressions that were in G mean nu before?
Oh, I simply wrote the wrong expressions for G mean nu. And the right expression for G mean nu is like this. Okay, so we have seen in two examples that approaching the critical point, results in a non-analytical behavior of either the Berry curvature, the adiabatic curvature, or the remaining tensor G mean nu. So that in general, it seems that what we're suspecting that at the critical point that the quantum geometric tensor would blow up, it is true. So of course, we just showed it in an example. So we would like to have a general argument. So the general argument is based on some scaling behavior that I will define. I will explain what it means. So I will first manipulate a little bit my Q min nu, and then make a scaling behavior argument to show when is that this object has to diverge. Okay, so I can take the absolute value of these components. Okay? And I would like to understand when any of these components would blow up. So to do this, I would like to produce an upper bound and then show that the object on the and then show something about this object here. So I will actually prove a statement about when this object cannot blow up. Okay, so the absolute value of these components is, of course, bounded by the norm of this operator, of the operator Q min nu. And, well, what is this norm? Well, this is nothing else but Q evaluated in some vector phi, where phi is the eigenvector corresponding to the maximum eigenvalue. So another way to say this is that if you want to know what is the operator norm of some operator, you diagonalize it, you take the maximum eigenvalue, and that is the operator norm. This provided that that they are positive, which is the case because Q mu nu is a positive matrix, and you can always diagonalize it because it's actually an Hermitian matrix. So also remember that we are diagonalizing this operator in the space mu nu. So I'm talking about the matrix that is labeled by mu nu. So this phi will have some components that are phi 1, phi n, where this n is the dimension of my manifold m. So let me hide this one. Okay. So now let me define by simply delta H what happens if I sum. So this object here that appears up there in the definition of my quantum geometric tensor, in this space, this is a vector, right? Because it's labeled by the components mu. In the space mu nu, it is a vector whose components are operators on the Hilbert space, but it's a vector in the space mu nu. So let me define this object. So this object is nothing else because of this definition here than dH phi. Okay. So if I plug this bound So I evaluate Q between phi and phi. In that expression, I will see that Q mu nu is smaller or equal than the sum of n greater than 0, then the, here I have my delta squared to the minus 2. And then I have psi 0 delta h psi n square. Well, because so each of the mu nu is smaller than this object here. But when you evaluate this object in there, that product becomes just this object square. But then this is what I wrote here. So I take the delta h and I evaluate between these vectors and I take the square. And here I have the gap, delta to the minus 2. OK. Well, now, so this delta has indexes n, right? It's the gap between n and 0. It's not the minimum gap. So now, of course, delta 1, 0 is smaller than or equal than delta n 0 for every n different from 0. So I can just produce another bound by pulling out this object, delta 1, 0 minus 2, and then I have this sum. OK, so now we do a trick. So this is just the sum for n greater than 0. But now I can add the 0 term. Now I can do it because I am only adding a term inside this parenthesis. I've already pulled out the delta. So I'm not putting in this expression delta 0, 0, which would be 0. So I sum over all the n's, and then I subtract this term. So I just subtract psi 0 delta h psi 0 square. OK, but now this term can be written, so now I use this trick, that this sum can be written like sum over n of psi 0 delta h psi n delta h psi 0, and one of these the admission function. Okay? And then you use the trick that the sum over all the eigenstates of these projectors is the identity. So this is a completeness relation. So this means that I can write this just like the expectation value in psi 0 of delta h dagger. So you see that this object becomes what I just said. So delta 1, 0 to the minus 2 times delta h dagger minus delta h square. So this starts looking like a correlation function. Okay, so now we use one of our interesting arguments, it's locality. So we first of all assume that the variation of my Hamiltonian is a local operator. So you can imagine that you vary your Hamiltonian. So one example in which this can happen is that your h of lambda is some h of 0 plus lambda, some operator v, which is the sum of local operators. So this is just one example. So in general, so we assume that our delta h is the sum of some local operator delta vj. Okay, so this is the locality assumption. Well, then what happens is that q mu nu is smaller than our delta 1, 0 to the minus 2 times delta b I delta b j. And here I have the sum over all I j's. Minus delta vi delta v dagger j. Okay, so this really starts looking like a correlation function. So now I will make another assumption. So imagine that we are treating with the translational invariant models. Well, just because I wrote this as delta h square. We should have it here too, you're right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so translational invariance is a very reasonable assumption for condensed matter models when there is no disorder. So typically it's disorder that breaks translational invariance. So these considerations are hold for non-disordered systems. And then it turns out that there are some numerical results to say that they also hold for disordered systems if the disorder is not too strong. But this requires direct calculation model by model. You cannot make a general proof. Okay, so if you have a translational invariance, then these objects do not really depend on I and j. So I could fix j equals 0, and then I could rename I. So, no, sorry, j equal r, and then I can, when I sum over all the i's, what I get is b to the minus 2, 1, 0. The sum of all the i's gives me the volume of my system. L to d is the dimension, the special dimension of my system. And then I have the sum over all the r's of some object kr, where kr is the vr, the v dagger 0 minus the vr, the vr, the v dagger 0. So this is really a correlation function. Okay. So let me rewrite this last line here. So these matrix elements are upper bounded by this to the minus 2, 1, 0, L to the D, SR, K to the R, K of R, sorry. Now let me define a density the density of my quantum geometric tensor, which is simply my quantum geometric tensor divided by the volume of my system. So you will also have that the components of this density are upper bounded by d to the minus 2, 1, 0, sum r k to the r. OK, and then we would like to take the thermodynamic limit and see what happens. OK, so now we see something that if the gap delta 1, 0 in the thermodynamic limit is greater than 0, so if the system has a gap, or in other terms, is non-critical, then, OK, so this is finite, d to the delta to the minus 2. And this is a correlation function for a gapped system. So this goes like e to the minus r. So this converges at every length. So this is converges to this upper bound converges to some value, which means that these components cannot blow up. So we see that the gaplessness is a necessary condition for Q min nu to blow up. So we cannot say that it's also a sufficient condition. But this means that if Q min nu blows up, then the system cannot be gapful. So it must be gapless. So our statement that if it blows up, then we see a quantum phase transition is true. So there are not many counterexamples, although, in which you have a gapless system that then we would like to call critical, and in which the quantum geometric tensor is not blowing up. But these counterexamples are remarkable. And it seems that this happens pretty much when the quantum geometric tensor, even for the critical point, has a very low sensitivity. So this means that there are some perturbations of the system that even if you send the gap to zero, you don't actually change your ground state too much. So this has consequences because it seems that then you can cross some critical point in a more adiabatic way than in other points. But there is no a complete, at this point, understanding of all the phenomenology of what are the counterexamples in which it can happen that this goes to zero and the quantum geometric tensor does not blow up. So what we can conclude is that if Q blows up, then we have a quantum phase transition. So this is the main message. Okay.
Condition for divergence delta 1, 0 is 0? I don't really
not
see.
Sufficient.
Not sufficient. Okay, good.
Okay. So now we move on to another topic, that is the relationship between entanglement and quantum phase transition. Okay, so to be able to talk about entanglement, we must first define a tensor product structure. So TPS stands for tensor product structure. And in our treatment of local systems, this is what we have naturally, because you remember that we that our Hilbert space is the tensor product of every x that belongs to our lattice of some local Hilbert space hx. So an entangled state is a state psi such that there is no choice of phi x in hx such that psi is the tensor product of this phi x. So if there is no way of writing it as a product state, then we say that it's okay. Now the interesting case, the most interesting case, is when we have a bipartite quantum state. So the bipartite case is the case in which we partition our lattice in two sets such that they don't intersect. So that we can write it in this way. And of course, HA is the tensor product of all the HX with X in A, and similarly for B. Okay, so in the bipartite case, we can always find a psi A labeled by some index I that is some orthonormal basis in HA, and similarly for B, so an orthonormal basis in HD. So it turns out that any state psi can be always written in a decomposition in which, as a basis in H, in the total H, you use product states of this type. So let me put J here now. I could put I. No, I have to put another index J. Okay. So actually, in the case in which the two spaces have the same dimensionality, I can put a I here. And I can also generalize when there are different dimensionalities by completing the basis of the smaller space. So it turns out that you can really write this in this way. So you have psi A I tensor phi, or psi would be this, psi B I. So this is called Schmidt decomposition. And this allows you to, so once we have found the Schmidt decomposition, you can easily find the reduced density matrix. So rho A is what you obtain if you take the density matrix associated to psi and trace out B. And the density matrix associated to psi is simply psi, ket psi, bra psi. Well, and so, of course, you can see, because the psi B are orthogonal, then this is simply sum of the squares of these numbers, C-A-I, C-A-I. So these are also the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. So finding the Schmidt decomposition is equivalent to finding the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. You might not want to do the Schmidt decomposition, that you just take the state in whatever basis you write it, you find the reduced density matrix, and then you find the eigenvalues alpha I square. Well, now you notice that because this is still a density matrix, its trace is 1. All these numbers are positive. But the trace is the sum. So trace rho A equal 1 means that sum of over I of alpha I square is 1. So this means that this alpha I square are a probability distribution. So now imagine that our state, we had found the Schmidt decomposition such that our state was actually a product state. So this means that we have only one coefficient here, right? We have only psi I, psi b. And because these states are orthonormal, this alpha must be 1. So this means that for a product state, the reduced density matrix always looks like this distribution probability is just 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Or in other terms, once I trace out the second part, if I start from a product state, I find another pure state. Okay? So if psi is a product state, so it's just psi A tensor psi B, then the reduced density matrix of rho A is just psi A tensor psi A, sorry, ket psi A bra psi A, which as a matrix looks like this. So we have probability 1 on being in the state, in the pure state, psi A, and probability 0 in being in some other state. So we don't have a mixture of pure quantum states. So the mixedness comes from the fact that we have many coefficients here. And these many coefficients are a probability distribution. So we would like to use the entropy of this probability distribution to measure how mixed the state is. And therefore, because this comes from the non-separability, define this entropy as a measure of the entanglement of our state, of our failure, of the state's failure of being a product state. So the so-called von Neumann entropy of the reduced density matrix is simply the what in information theory is called Shannon entropy of this probability distribution, which is simply minus I alpha I square log of alpha I square. So this is the von Neumann entropy. So we have seen that somehow this is related to how entangled these states are. And we are choosing it by definition as a measure of entanglement. But we would like to know whether it's a good measure. So what we ask from a measure of entanglement is that that is continuous in a row A, and you so it's one can prove that, and that is additive. So this means that if I have a state psi so psi in AB and then I have another state, psi prime, in AB. And I take the tensor product of these two. So I have two copies of my system. And then I compute the entropy of this. This must be equal to the entropy of just the first state. So remember that this the entropy of this state is the von Neumann entropy, means that we must make a cut, trace out to the rest, and compute the entropy of the reduced density matrix. Otherwise, the entropy of just a pure state is always zero, plus the entropy of psi prime, AB. By this, I mean the von Neumann entropy. So what happens on the reduced system? Right? I have to cut and trace out B. Yes. So a byproduct, so from this, the von Neumann entropy has also the property that if I trace out A, so if I compute the density matrix, reduce density matrix to the system B, I compute the Shannon entropy, meaning this formula for this probability distribution. The probability distribution of a density matrix means the eigenvalue. So this, then I find the same thing done on the system A. OK, so these are definitions. So tomorrow we will see how these and some other entanglement measures are linked to the quantum phase transitions. But you can already guess it a little bit, because we know that S is continuous in the state. And we saw that when some derivative of the energy with respect to some parameter is a non-analytic, this can only be because there is some non-analyticity in the state. So because S is a continuous function of the state, a non-analyticity in row can only come from a non-analyticity in the state. So that's why this function can spot the quantum phase transitions. So that shouldn't come to too much surprise. Then there are other properties of entanglement that are useful. So we will see that tomorrow in the first, hopefully, 15 minutes, because it's a not a huge, so I don't want to focus too much on that topic. And then we will start our treatment of this type of systems that you heard a lot me mentioning, that are topologically ordered systems. Questions?